Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Today's episode is presented by Meta.
A virtual reality platform created by Fundamental VR and Orbis International helps train doctors to treat cataracts, resulting in more confident surgeons operating worldwide. Meta and the metaverse are having impact today.
Hi everyone, we have a special end-of-year edition of Politico's EU Confidential podcast coming up after a message from this week's sponsor.
For more than 100 years, Raytheon has proven its commitment to partnering with industries and allies in Europe to advance new technologies and increase protection against a full spectrum of threats. In a world of uncertainty, Raytheon is defending our transatlantic partners by creating trusted, tested, and innovative solutions that make the world a safer place.
Welcome to a special bumper end-of-year edition of Politico's EU Confidential podcast. Ryan Heath has headed off on holiday, I'm Andrew Gray, but nobody else seems to have got the memo about taking things easy. It's been a very busy week in European politics. The European Court of Justice told Uber it's a transport company, who knew? The European Commission told Poland it was trampling on the rule of law and could lose its right to vote inside the EU, although it probably won't. Theresa May told her deputy he'd have to quit, losing her third cabinet minister in 2 months. And as we put the podcast together, the people of Catalonia are going to the polls at the end of a tumultuous year there. There's been so much going on, it feels like last year, not last week, that EU leaders gave the green light for phase two of the Brexit talks. Now, in this week's edition, we have one of the best talkers in Brussels, NATO's Deputy Assistant Secretary General, Jamie Shea. He's been in the city for nearly 40 years, and in our interview, we talk about how Brussels has changed during that time. We also talk about his role as NATO's frontman during the Kosovo War, and about the challenges the alliance faces today. So Russia and Ukraine get a mention, as does cyber warfare and hybrid warfare, and also the EU's new defence pact, PESCO. That's all coming up in this week's EU Confidential. But first, a brief review of the year. I rounded up some of Politico's policy reporters, the people who cover the nitty-gritty of what goes on inside the EU every day, and asked them to pick out the big stories on their beats in 2017 and why they mattered. So let's hear from them, and you'll hear a few other familiar voices as well.
Hello, my name's Simon Marks, and I cover food and agriculture here at Politico. Without a doubt, the biggest story on my beat this year was Europe's decision to renew the license for glyphosate for another 5 years. This was a major sticking point that was a huge deal for the pesticide industry, who feared that the world's biggest selling chemical in the agriculture sector might not have been renewed. Farmers were extremely worried, thinking they might have to change their entire model and way of doing farming. Environmental groups in the end were extremely disappointed, having lobbied actively and ferociously on this issue.
I am fighting every day for the great people of this country. Therefore, in order to fulfill my solemn duty to protect America and its citizens, the United States will withdraw from the Paris Climate Accord.
My name is Kalina Oroshakov, and I cover energy and climate policy in Europe. In terms of what I think the biggest story this year was for me on the climate beat, was definitely the actual announcement of Donald Trump, the US president, that he would withdraw the United States from the Paris climate deal. It was an anticipated announcement, yet when it came, everyone was still shocked, and it provoked a flurry of reactions, especially from European countries, not least France and Germany, Italy, and of course European Commission, which have long been seen as major climate leaders, so to speak, trying to reassert themselves, also trying to send the US a message that just announcing a withdrawal of the Paris climate deal wouldn't mean that the rest of the world would follow suit and that any efforts to cut emissions and prepare the world for hotter temperatures would stop as a consequence of Trump's announcement. I think in terms of the biggest effect on the EU, one could definitely see that European leaders, including Commission President Jean-Claude Juncker, suddenly started to talk about climate much more, also using it as a diplomatic way of forging closer ties with China, for example, which before had formed a G2 with the US. Since China and the US are the two biggest polluters in the world, these two really carried the heaviest weight in that whole debate. And now with the US, at least the White House, out of the picture largely, it was again time for the EU to step forward. Of course, there are questions whether the EU can do it as a body of 28 or soon 27 countries, with each having different interests and economic concerns. And I think over the next years, we will see whether the EU can really fill that gap. Many say it can't. And of course, there's also the argument whether it's absolutely necessary to fill it because there are more and newer players that are becoming ever more important in the global fight against climate change, including cities. Companies are stepping up and other non-national or non-government players, so to speak.
France will not give up the fight. I reaffirm clearly that the Paris Agreement remains irreversible and will be implemented. Make our planet great again.
Hi, my name is Kate Bolangero, and I am Politico's Fisheries and Oceans journalist. The biggest story on my beat this year, I would say, is the push for quotas in the Mediterranean. Fisheries Commissioner Carmen Uvella has made it his goal to bring in more fisheries management tools to the Mediterranean. It's one of the most overfished basins in the EU, and it also has some of the least amount of regulation, because a lot of the boats are small, and small boats are often exempt from regulation. So the Commission has made it its goal to make sure that it can regulate the Mediterranean better and to make sure that it has the same rules as the rest of the EU basins. This year they brought in quota for swordfish, which was a fish that was very exploited and it was overexploited. So that is something that they've been working on, and it's been a few years in the making. Now they're trying to bring in a plan for the Adriatic Sea, which would involve Slovenia, Croatia, and Italy for small pelagic, so that's anchovies and sardines. So that plan is expected next year, but there's been a lot of developments over this year about it, and it's very much a big fish fight because Italy has not wanted to bring in quotas at all. Croatia and Slovenia appear to be a little more flexible, but it's definitely going to be tough for the Commission to really bring into fisheries management in the region an idea of quotas and total allowable catches.
Today, we agreed in principle on the future economic partnership agreement. The depth of this agreement goes far beyond our shores.
Hi, my name is Hans von der Burchardt. I'm trade reporter with Politico, and after last year, I was somehow like the CETA guy on the Canada trade agreement, which was a big thing. This year, I became the Japan guy, and at the end of last year, we had a breakdown of talks in Tokyo. We saw again a big push this year of actually following up on this decision by the Trump administration, the U.S. withdrawal from the Trans-Pacific Partnership, a big deal including 11 countries in the Pacific region. This withdrawal caused a big shock and motivated many countries to engage in new negotiations or intensify negotiations with Europe. And so also Japan, they somehow saw that it's time to switch horses from the U.S. towards the European Union. So we saw these trade talks really gaining traction again in March, and we were kind of like reporting on how this came to a big push, a political push in July to do a political agreement on this deal, to finally agree on the sensitive issues like car tariffs and agriculture tariffs, which was before always an area where Japan would never wanted to do a deal. And yeah, then we had this deal actually just concluded now in beginning of December, and for the first time, actually, the European Union decided to really split an agreement. The European Union and Japan could not agree on the provisions of how foreign investors could eventually sue. So in the end, they had to for this splitting of trade agreements, which was a big thing now that trade agreements can be ratified easier by having the one big trade part passing here in Brussels, and the investment part eventually, if they agree at some stage, will go through the national parliaments.
Today, the Commission has decided to fine Google 2.4 billion euros for breaching EU antitrust rules. Google has abused its market dominance as a search engine by giving illegal advantages to another Google product, its shopping comparison service.
I'm Laurens Cyrulis. I cover privacy and cybersecurity here at Politico in Brussels. So for technology and politics, 2017 was the year of big tech. Not because companies like Google and Facebook were incredibly influential, maybe dominant in some markets, but also because big tech like big pharma or big tobacco became a synonym for an industry that sort of has gone off the rails. In 2017, we've seen European regulators sort of frowning at what companies like Facebook, Google, and others have been doing when it comes to market dominance, the lack of competition in a lot of markets, privacy concerns over what is being done with people's data, with European citizens' personal data, and also debates like fake news, which are about distorting information. And so the initial idea of the internet as sort of a force for good, as an infrastructure to exchange information, that got a big dent this year because politicians started really asking critical questions about the promises that internet companies make of making the world a better place. Increasingly, people are wondering, do internet companies actually make the world a better place? And this is something that 2017 will certainly be remembered for the start of a pushback towards the dominance of these companies.
A selection of the big stories on the beats of Politico's policy reporters in 2017. And in a moment, we'll head for NATO headquarters for an interview with Deputy Assistant Secretary General for Emerging Security Challenges, Jamie Shea. That's after a message from this week's sponsor.
Every day, Raytheon's most advanced capabilities, ranging from missile defense to cyber, help NATO allies protect what matters most. Our long-standing partnerships with European industry drive local innovation and allow small and medium enterprises to benefit from international programs and technology transfer. From outer space to cyberspace, Raytheon's network of interoperable systems turns data into defense, giving European partners the most modern and reliable protection.
Now, just before our interview, a reminder that you can rate or review this podcast on Apple Podcasts and various other platforms, and we're always very grateful when you do. You can also send us feedback to playbook@politico.eu. And now, as promised, our interview with NATO's Jamie Shea. It was, as they say in this business, a wide-ranging conversation. He's been in Brussels since 1980, so there was a lot to talk about, including his time as spokesman during NATO's first war, the Kosovo War, when he became something of a household name for a couple of months at least. And we talk a bit about the challenges that that posed. We also talk about NATO today, and he mentions three particular fronts or challenges that NATO faces. A more conventional one with Russia to the east. He talks about the Southern Front and the challenges of instability in North Africa and the Middle East. And he talks, if you like, about the internal front, the fact that NATO countries can be destabilized from within by adversaries who can target everything from the media to power networks to online tax systems. So there was a lot to talk about, but I began by asking him what Brussels was like when he arrived here in 1980 and how it's changed.
Well, I think the pace of life was massively slower, of course. In NATO, it was the Cold War still. It was still sort of a decade when I came before the Berlin Wall came down, so it was still very much in the throes of the Cold War. And, of course, at that time, you know, NATO didn't have all of these multiple missions in Afghanistan, in the Gulf of Aden, in Libya, in the Balkans, everything that we've developed since. It just had one single mission, one single purpose, which, to be frank with you, was to wait to be attacked, if I can put it that way. Obviously, to provide a balance of power in the East on the assumption that, you know, this would deter the Soviet Union. And therefore, the success of NATO was boredom. In a funny kind of way, it was the fact that nothing happened from day one. You didn't want anything to happen because the only happening scenario would have been a confrontation, which of course everybody was trying to avoid. And so to some degree, yes, the pace of life was slow. And this organisation was totally different. It was much more MAO, very few women around apart from secretary functions. Thank God that's changed massively. And when I came along, the alliance was 15 members. So if you think today it's virtually sort of doubled, you can imagine that it was less colourful with essentially North American and Western European member states. And the profile of many of the people on the international staff, I was the exception, of course, coming along as a youngster, were sort of retired colonels who had had a military career and were serving on the international staff. So the organisation, as I say, was far less diverse than what it is today, and essentially sort of looking through binoculars of what was going on in the Warsaw Pact. But deterrence had worked for a long, long time since the alliance was set up in the 1940s, so there was no great reason to change it. That said, I did have a little bit of an excitement in the early years, because the Soviet leader in the mid-70s, Leonid Brezhnev, had decided to deploy these SS-20 missiles. I don't know, Andrew, if you remember this. You're too young. But these were sort of a new generation of intermediate range missiles that were pointed at Western Europe. And NATO had adopted a twin track decision, as we called it, in 1979, just before I arrived, to deploy Cruise and Pershing nuclear weapons in Europe as a counter. And that, for a while, created quite a stir with peace movements. Remember CND, the Greenham Common Peace Camp in the UK, equivalents over here. And to some degree, that was a challenge for NATO, but it was a great opportunity for me, because that got me into public diplomacy and press and PR for the first time, as I got a job of making the case for why, SS-20s were bad and Cruise and Pershing were, not being aggressive, but responding. And indeed, I often joke with my students that at home I still have a picture of Leonid Brezhnev. And when I go home at night, I say, thank you, Leonid, in a perverse way, by which I mean, if you hadn't done this, I would never have got, out of this infrastructure committee that I was sitting on at the time, looking at tarmac on airfields, and got into something much more stimulating for me, which is press and media work. But so in other words, yes, NATO was much quieter than today. There's none of the hyperactivism that you see. Similarly with Brussels. I mean, the EU was there, of course, but same thing. Vastly reduced membership, fewer attributions, no external action service at that time, only a couple of pillars rather than the three plus that we have now. You didn't have all of the think tanks, a much smaller press corps, and the like, and Brussels was much more of a provincial town. It really didn't have the feel of a sort of major international centre that it's had since. Of course, it's now changed, but it's, I think, on every front, changed for the better.
I wanted to ask about your time as the spokesman during the Kosovo War. I imagine was a real step change. It's one thing, a briefing on policy or exercises, but this is NATO for the first time going into military action against a sovereign country. How did you adapt to that? How big a shock, I guess, was it suddenly to be kind of front and centre on televised briefings, the kind of the face of the war in some ways?
Well, for a short period, remember the famous Warhol dictum of 50, famous for 15 minutes sort of thing, certainly. I think that the shock was, in a way, that for a year, not only we, the EU, the powers, as we call them, were in a diplomacy phase, where it was the threat of force rather than the use of force, and the belief that the threat of force would avoid the use of force. Remember the Serb leader at the time, Milosevic, came under a lot of pressure, and I think in NATO there was a genuine view that provided we made that threat of force credible, he ultimately would agree to an accommodation with the Kosovo Albanians. Not on independence, that wasn't what we were looking for at the time, but purely to withdraw some of his police forces and stop, obviously, the harassment of the Albanian, the Kosovo Albanian population. And when that didn't succeed, and suddenly we found ourselves having to sort of cross the Rubicon and use force. To some degree, we weren't prepared for it at the time. I mean, there were military plans, but nobody understood that when you're threatening use of force, public media attention can be pretty low, but when you're actually using force, it's a completely different story. And for me, this was illustrated in a very clear way when the day before, on March the 22nd, the day before we announced the beginning of the air campaign, there were five journalists downstairs in NATO, in the press area, the launch press theatre, and I swear I'm not exaggerating, the next day 450 The media, in fact, mobilised as fast as the NATO military, if not faster. Unbelievable. And they were there, as you probably heard from some of your old-timer friends in Brussels, more or less throughout the next 78 days, they didn't budge. So we suddenly had a problem of not only accurate information being put, test, because obviously while the negotiations were going on, we didn't have to communicate very much. So a sudden need to get out accurate information, but also on a 24-hour news cycle. The old NATO, a press conference every 3 weeks or once a month, had to give way to several press conferences a day. Got to really provide the information and the facts quickly. And of course, that puts you under pressure, because the more information you're giving more quickly, the more chance you're going to make mistakes, get it wrong, and then your credibility can suffer.
Was that a kind of battle you had to win inside NATO? Were there some people saying, no, we should just do propaganda, we should just, mislead, or, within the greater goal, it's acceptable to do that kind of thing?
I think, you've heard of Clausewitz, the fog of war, yeah. And that was true. Today, hopefully, we're in an age now with satellites, with drones, with sensors, in NATO today, a much more focused intelligence collection effort. We've got this new division now, which we've set up, the intelligence division, with civilian military feeds. You saw with ZAPAD that NATO, the ZAPAD maneuver with Russia recently, that NATO had a much more focused effort to be able to sort of assess what was going on. So I think massive, there's been that enormous shift. With massive, if you look at military budgets today, what's going on in the information technology side, sensors, satellites, drones, robotization, integration, big data, algorithms, real-time situational awareness, data fusion, data distribution, so that the private soldier today, in his helmet, has more awareness than a general in the First World War in his chateau. It's true. Behind the lines of the entire thing. It's just like, there's more computing power in your iPhone, about six times more than there was in NASA in the late 1960s in the United States. Obvious things to say. So, now I think that shift has occurred. But of course, in 1999, it still wasn't quite that case.
I'll ask just a couple more on Kosovo and then come on to the present. I'm curious about a couple of things. One is that I think at one point, Alistair Campbell, Tony Blair's spin doctor in chief, was kind of dispatched here to help you out. What kind of an experience was that? What was that like?
Well, it was an interesting experience, and I've been very complimentary about Alistair, and I will remain complimentary. I mean, when you're in an operation, you've got what NATO is doing, but you've got also what the nations are doing. The MOD, the Pentagon in the United States, the German Defense Ministry, they are flying the planes. NATO doesn't have planes, they're the nations integrated into a NATO command structure. So if you really want to know what's going on, you have to have a feed with Washington, you have to have a feed with London, and so on. And I think, and I made this clear, what Alistair was really able to do, obviously being close to Tony Blair at the time, it was able to bring in the integration of those various capitals in a way that made it much easier, so that we could tell them what we were saying, they could tell us. If there was an incident, we could have a conference call immediately on those capitals. What do you know? What's happened? What can we reliably say that we know is true? What do we need to find out? When can we find it out? The second thing, he was able to mobilise a lot of resources. The NATO press service was tiny at the time because we weren't used to fighting wars or having press briefings around the clock. And Alistair was able, simply, within the UK government, to sort of go to the government communications centre and say, right, I need 30 media monitors to come and help NATO monitor press. And believe it or not, the next day they were here. There was one Scottish lady who was shopping in Glasgow, in Socky Hall Street, who tells me that she was literally phoned up by Alistair, dropped her shopping bags, and was on a plane within hours to Brussels. We were organised for peacetime. Maybe, yes, self-criticism, we should have internally been more geared up for the surge that you need when, you've got CNN coming in at 3 o'clock in the morning saying we need a briefing for our Asian audience. So I understood that. I understand that now. But as I say, at the time, that was he was a hard taskmaster, because running election campaigns for the Labour Party, you can imagine. But in a way, it gave us, I think, a necessary discipline.
Right. And also, the other thing is, obviously, if you're a spokesman, if you have to front up and perhaps always and defend things that perhaps sometimes you're not comfortable defending. And I wondered if there were ever there were times during that war where you felt, I don't, for example, the bombing of the television station in Belgrade, which was very controversial, where you thought, I've got to go out and defend this, but I'm not, you know, this is not really what I would have wanted to do.
Look, you know, if you don't believe in something, you're not going to be convincing, right? You know, if you don't believe in God yourself, you're hardly going to sort of convert anybody, and so you have to basically believe in what you're doing to be a spokesman. That's absolutely true, not uncritically, because clearly you also have to be able to have a say in the decision making process, in the policy and how things are presented. So internally, you have to have a voice.
You know, in recent years, you're looking at future challenges for NATO. Do you ever get have you ever had the sense in recent years that things are coming full circle, in that, you know, we talked about when you first arrived here and the focus being on the Warsaw Pact, Soviet Union, and suddenly, if you like, in recent years, to, you know, put it crudely, Russia is back. Russia is a focus for NATO in a way that it wasn't, you know, maybe a decade ago or more. Do you see similarities, or is this a completely different scenario? It just happens to be Russia again that's the focus.
Well, I certainly think that we have to take account again in a way that maybe we didn't do over the last 25 years after the collapse of the Berlin Wall, of what you might call geopolitics or state-on-state rivalries in a more competitive world. That I think there is some truth in that. I think that we now do live in a world in which everything is contested. You can't any longer talk about my space. You know, for example, the Mediterranean, the Romans called that Mare Nostrum, our sea. And for a long time, for example, you wouldn't have seen any Russian ships in the Mediterranean after the collapse of the Soviet Union. But now they're back. And I don't mean this in a way that we see Russia as an adversary there, but simply that, you know, other people are present. China now sails its ships through the Mediterranean, even exercises with the Russians in the Baltics, is in the high north. Again, it's not an aggressive thing. It's simply that we now geopolitically in a more competitive type of world. Cyber, of course, is also a good example of where, you know, people interfere in your domains. You know, nothing is sacred any longer. You know, in your elections, in your media space, you know, in funding your political party, you know, other political parties. So I think that, you know, part of this is a recognition that, you know, we now have to focus once again on great powers and balancing great powers. I hope that clearly we don't have to do what we did during the Cold War in order to be successful in doing this. Because remember, during the Cold War, there were 300,000 American troops, there were 7,000 tactical nuclear weapons deployed in Europe, and UK had 60,000 of the British Army, the Rhine, the French 40,000. You get the idea, and I don't think anybody wants to, you know, have to go back to that type of level of military mobilisation in order to ensure peace in Europe. And I think what NATO is doing at the moment is, you know, a much, obviously, more modest deployment to show, you know, solidarity, political will, determination, but in a way that's clearly non-provocative, and in a way which I think sends a clear signal to Russia that, look, you know, there's no inevitability that we have the kind of arms race situation we had during the Cold War, and, you know, let's now sit down and talk and balance this at much lower levels of forces. You know, we've been proposing to the Russians things like risk reduction measures and transparency of exercises and so on. And let's hope in 2018 we have some success of that. So, yes, in terms of having once again to take account the great power rivalries, you know, we can't exist in any longer in a world where everything is Bosnia or everything is Kosovo or everything is Afghanistan. No. But there are two big changes vis-a-vis that. The first change is the one we've been talking about, this capacity of states to be able to interfere far more on the home front of states than was the case. I mean, if you think of the Soviet Union, it was a very powerful country, but its influence within Western countries after the communist parties began to decline in the 1950s was minimal. You know, Soviet propaganda, the influence of that, you know, did people watch Soviet TV like they watch RT today? Did they read TASS like they read Sputnik? I mean, you get where I'm coming from. I mean, clearly not. You know, did the Soviet Union have the control of energy networks? You know, or, you know, was it a big investor on our stock exchanges? I mean, again, no. So that's, I think, the first big change. The second big change is that we also now have the South, which we didn't have during the Cold War, when We had this belt of countries to our south that didn't always have the most favourable regimes, but still had a certain degree of stability, which in the wake of all of the turmoil and turbulence, Syria and so on, Libya, has gone now, which of course is generating a lot of headaches. Many of them, of course, not going to be tackled by a classical military response, but they're going to require a long-term effort in capacity building, reform, assistance in that region. NATO can't play that role alone, but on the other hand, the allies, particularly those in the south, do expect NATO to be part of that. So in other words, during the Cold War, when we started the conversation, you asked me about NATO in 1980, we only had to worry about a very small area of the world, the Fulda Gap, that was it, Checkpoint Charlie, and a balance of power, but was largely static, with a rather predictable Soviet Union, which had become very conservative and to some degree was far more predictable than what we have with Russia today, where there's a much smaller, less transparent group of people calling the shots.
Less transparent than even the old Politburo, you think?
Well, there were a lot more people involved. Generally, don't claim to be a criminologist, but generally, the Soviet Union that I knew at the time in 1980, the chairman of the Central Committee was not, a supreme ruler. But again, now we have these two other fronts, the so-called hybrid front and the South. So, now NATO has to walk with three legs and not just one leg.
Just explain the hybrid front a bit more.
Well, the hybrid front is this notion that you can lose your social cohesion at home and you can suddenly find all kinds of polarisation and rifts occurring in your society, which are not necessarily only the result of interference by another power. Let's be honest, we have our rifts anyway, right? But another power can quickly come in and say, ha-ha, fertile territory, there's a referendum here, and I can, exploit, I can polarise, I can inject some fake news, and I can, push the knife in the wound and make this even more uncomfortable for a government. And the means to do this today are massively greater. As I say, you have business networks, you have media networks, you have funding of political parties, you have populist trend that plays into this. You're also dealing with a climate, well, let's face it, classical liberalism, multilateralism, institutional integration are not necessarily as popular or seen as the future than they once were, where people believe in security by putting up walls. So to some degree, hybrid warfare is a kind of mixture of issues that we have, which we have to address. I think looking at what's going on in Ukraine at the moment is a test case that we need to examine very, very, very clearly. I mean, virtually nothing that Ukraine has, nothing. Its election campaign, its electricity grid, its airline booking, its MDOC tax registration service. There's nothing that hasn't been attacked. Its telecom system has been taken down. Its cable under the Black Sea in 2014 was cut. It's a real object exercise in how you can literally bully an independent country and subjugate it. And I'm not saying that what works in Ukraine would work here, because clearly we have a high degree of resilience, but we know that there are vulnerabilities also that could be exploited. With the EU, for the first time for many years anyway, we had this year our first coordinated exercise with the EU, looking at these hybrid scenarios, looking at a common scenario that both the NATO and the EU accepted to work off of. So they played the scenario looking at how they would play it. And we played it looking at how we would play it, because different culture. They would intervene more early with civil assets. We would intervene perhaps later because it's a military asset. But the idea is that it's joined up so that somebody is doing something. You don't have big gaps. And at the end of it, we can have lessons learned exercise where we sort of sense, basically what we can learn from the way they handled it and what they can learn from the way we handled it, and how gradually, we harmonise procedures.
You mentioned the European Union. I've just come from the summit at which PESCO, the Permanent Structured Cooperation, this new EU military cooperation pact, has been formally launched. There's obviously been a lot of debate over the years about the danger of duplication with NATO or competition with NATO. How do you view that now in terms of, I know that Secretary General Stoltenberg was there, obviously officially has NATO's blessing, but it's not uncomplicated, right? I mean, it's not without its challenges too to make that work.
Well, I mean, start from first premises. I mean, the United States is very clear that the Europeans have got to do more. That's accepted. And the Europeans are also clear that it doesn't just come from NATO, it comes from EU summits, that they have to do more too. First principle. Second principle, very easy. The EU has a very fragmented set of capabilities, markets, you know, just a statistic, US 30 major weapon systems, EU 176 major weapon systems, six times more. You know, EU, about 50% of the military capability is not usable, lack of spare parts, lack of maintenance, and so on. You know, and then we get into the duplication on R&D and training and equipment and all these things. So it's obvious that it's no good the EU countries spending all of them 2% more, which is the NATO benchmark. I know that would be very good if they do so, but it's no good if they do that under the existing business model, which is then wasting a lot of the money through the same duplication and fragmentation and so on. So it's got to be about spending more, but then, of course, you know, spending it better through integration. For example, McKinsey has just done a study, which you may have seen, Andrew. It's very good. You know, with the Munich Security Conference, they point out that, for example, if all of the EU countries spend 2%, but up their investment from 20% to 30%, this would free up $115 billion dollars a year, which could then be spent on capability and so on. I think NATO clearly understands that, you know, extra effort has to also mean greater sort of integration of effort. Yeah, otherwise we're not going to get, you know, that big extra boost.
Should that integration be within NATO or, you know, with under the EU umbrella?
Well, I think that essentially both organisations are going to carry this forward. You know, we're working on that as well. But also, of course, you know, the EU can do a lot on its side with PESCO and treaty based. Essentially, you know, if you've got two guys rowing the boat, you're going to get downstream a lot faster than if one guy.
But if they're not rowing at the same rhythm, you might have.
Now you've said the same thing. I think on the NATO side, therefore, you know, we can be the big beneficiaries of all this because, you know, a stronger Europe is going to be good for NATO. US is going to be happier, you know, and keep its commitment to organisations which are also relevant and responsive to US interests. President Trump's made that clear. And of course, you know, the EU would then also have capabilities to do things like in Mali or wherever, that were, you know, Central African Republic. But there are exactly three sort of basic rules of the road that I'm not sure if I'm using the right expression of rules of the road, but sort of three principles that NATO would like to see. Number one, of course, is let's avoid duplication. So if one organisation is doing something really well, you know, with a particular program which is working perfectly well, no need to get the same scientists and the same people, you know, meeting in a different place working on a parallel program. So let's see, you know, who essentially is having the most success with a particular type of capability. That's the first thing. Second thing, that when these capabilities are formed, you know, NATO in fact doesn't have any forces, and neither does the EU really. You know, we have some AWACS aircraft, but let's consider that it's a single set of forces. So we should increasingly make those sets of forces available to either organisation according to need. So that, I think, is a good principle too. NATO is defending many EU countries, and we're partnering with Finland and Sweden as well up in the Baltic area. So, you know, there's nothing, there's no reason why, you know, what NATO is doing would not also be an EU priority, because if NATO didn't exist, the EU would clearly need to protect its own members. And then, let's have a sense of this kind of, you know, according to the demand availability. So there's no reason why this shouldn't benefit NATO's defence in the East, and at the same time, you know, also joint operations together in the South. The third principle is that, you know, we've got a number of non-EU allies, Turkey, notably, Norway, but others, you know, Iceland, or Canada, obviously, the United States. We're also going to have the UK as a non-EU NATO ally. So clearly, you know, they want to make a contribution. They could make a valuable contribution. I mean, the UK, for example, is 25% of EU defence spending at the moment, 25% of capabilities. So the principle we'd like here is that, just like NATO reaches out to EU countries not in NATO, like Finland and Sweden. And so similarly, on the EU side, reach out to, you know, our allies who are not in the EU to reinforce so that we have a certain reciprocity. One of the key things is that we have similar capability requirements. You know, because if we have one set of EU requirements that says the priority is helicopters, and NATO saying, no, the priority is transport aircraft, and you, poor defence minister, are thinking, well, what is it? You know, no. So, you know, we come out with a common set of the kind of, in other words, our view of forces, military forces, is identical. You know, and whether, if the EU is better at delivering one package, that's fine. But as long as our overall concept of what kind of force structure we need is there, then, you know, different countries politically will, you know, for different reasons. You know, one country, for example, may find, okay, the EU route is more attractive to me because of the way in which a consortium is structured or the financing arrangements. Another country will say, no, I'm more comfortable with the NATO approach. And when you get into the nitty-gritty, different countries have, you know, different sort of mechanisms in terms of, you know, their parliaments or their funding or the timeline or whatever. So it's not such a bad idea to give them sort of two routes. You know, you take the high road and I take the low road, you say Scotland. But, you know, but as long as we get to Scotland, right, as the song says at the end of the day, yeah.
That's the important thing. Thanks very much for your time.
My pleasure.
NATO's Jamie Shea talking to me in his office at NATO headquarters on Friday of last week. And that wraps up another edition of EU Confidential. In fact, that wraps up the podcast for this year because we're taking next week off. We'll be back as usual in the first week of January. Thanks for their help with this week's episode to Cynthia Kroot and to Weidong Lin and Antonio Fernandez. And thanks to you for listening this week and this year. Look forward to speaking to you again in 2018.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.